Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 4:37 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is October 21st, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I've certainly had time to refresh my ideas because this is the second time I've been recording. I basically butt dialed. I sat on my push to talk button on the headphones, and that turned off the audio halfway through the last recording. So here we go again. But I thought that the most important things that are happening right now is that we're starting to see some softening up in the strength of the dollar. So I've been saying for a while now that a 110 on the dollar index is a big psychological level. But I think it's also worth, and I think it's exceptionally important to highlight that we've had three downside key reversals for the dollar in a month. And the last one was today. So we're definitely getting some softening up in the performance of the US dollar. And this is potentially significant. So why would that happen? Well, the first thing is that today the deficit contracted. So there was calendar effects that contributed to that. But there were two additional facts. That one, the US government is spending less money. And that's because the pandemic spending has come to an end. So that's helping to contract the deficit. Then there's the other side of the balance sheet, which is that tax receipts have been really strong. Well, of course, tax receipts have been strong because the economy has been really steady and unemployment is at low levels. The number of people working in the economy is at the highest ever. And this is an environment which has contributed to the federal government and the states having record income. But then you also have capital gains tax. So we've had an environment this year where stocks have been coming down. And then let's just think about what that looks like. So I remember having conversations with parents in my daughter's school. This must have been when they were, let's see, my eldest is now in 11th grade. So when she was in third grade, 8 years ago, that people were saying, well, if Amazon just goes up a bit more, I'll be able to retire early. So there's lots of people who were invested in the NASDAQ, invested in growth stocks and technology in 2012, 13, 14, 15, 16, and still. Well, you can't have prices come down like they have this year without people taking profits. And the capital gains tax on a highly appreciated asset is about 20%. So people selling, if they've held it for more than a year, they pay 20% on their profits. And some of those people will have had big profits. And that's contributed to a big surge in capital gains tax. Well, you don't get to sell a highly appreciated asset twice. So therefore, that would suggest that the tax receipts aren't going to increase next year. And just to put some, I guess, a personal effect on that, I was able to protest my property tax earlier on this year, and it didn't go up this year. But that's because the municipality has plenty of cash. When you go into a recession, property taxes go up because the municipality doesn't have as much cash. And then you get higher taxes into an environment where public services are under pressure. So that's certainly not something that's going to be welcome in society. But then let's also think, so that's just the jump in capital gains tax that's normal. But then let's also just look at LIBOR. Because we now have SOFR and we have new rates that people are using, but a lot of floating rate debt was attached to LIBOR. And there was no risk in LIBOR between 2012 and 2016. And there was no risk in LIBOR in 2020 and 2021. So there was a boom in LMAs, which basically allow you to stake your assets, like your stock portfolio, in order to get a loan to make a big purchase like a home. So you can use your stock portfolio as your deposit. And doing that means you can first avoid your capital gains tax. So you can do it to manage your tax exposure. And then, of course, you are holding on to your stocks because you think they're going to keep going up. And in 2021, stocks went up a lot. So people didn't want to sell. So then they were holding on because they thought that their capital appreciation would more than compensate them for the expense of taking out a loan against the portfolio. But then in 2022, interest rates have started to rise. So now what you have are all of those LMAs, to the extent that they were attached to LIBOR, well, now they are trading at 430 basis points higher. And that's a big interest expense. But then the stock portfolios are down about 20%. So then that means that there will be a fresh call. Now, when you're being asked to capitalize, then the stock portfolio isn't a one for one, obviously. There's usually it's going to be about a double. So if you are going to borrow 200,000, well then you have to put down significantly more than that in terms of your stock portfolio value. But the problem is that the further stocks go down, then the more difficult it is to hold on. If the bank, who now basically controls your portfolio, decides they're going to sell, then you are going to be hit both by selling at an inopportune time and having to pay the capital gains tax. So that's a really difficult situation to be in. But it's just an indication of just where liquidity is coming out of the system. So we've had a great deal of stress in the market. Now, when we think about the dollar starting to weaken, that's more about economic weakness. Well, one of the biggest threats to the performance of gold has been the dollar. So the dollar has had three downside Q reversals in a month, and gold has had two upside Q reversals in a month. Now, the last time we've had an upside Q reversal in gold, it put on about $100. So each of these ranges is about $100, a little bit more or a little bit less. And we had about $100 advance after the last Q reversal. So it would be normal to anticipate that the price will now go up to around the $1,725 level. And that's on the back of anticipating that the dollar weakness will persist for a while longer. Now, it would be very easy to say that this is the low and the dollar has peaked and stock markets are going to roar back after a day like we had today. The Nasdaq was up in a reasonably dynamic manner, tacking on an extra couple of hundred points, and we had the upside Q reversal last week. So it's now testing the sequence of lower rally highs, and I think that it could possibly go back up and test the region of the 200-day moving average. But the Federal Reserve is going to keep raising rates, and inflationary pressures have not yet peaked, and unemployment is not rising. And that suggests that what we're seeing right now is a little bit of steadier action. I sold out of my short position because I anticipated that there would be a rebound. And it looks like that rebound is starting to occur now. But I'm still ready to increase my short position, or not increase. Well, it is increasing because I still have my put options, but I'm going to add another short futures position when I see an additional rally. because I don't think that we're at the end of this hiking cycle, and there are growing risks in the bond markets. Now, just like I think the LME issue is problematic for large numbers of consumers, I think that the leveraged loan issue is problematic for lots of institutions. So this is the Selective US Dollar China Corporate High Yield Bond Index. And it probably is instructive to know what the background is. Chinese property developers are exceptionally capital hungry. So they were having what they basically do is move into an area of access to leverage and then max it out. And the Chinese government has been worried about the growth of the leverage in the property sector now for really quite some time. So this has contributed to them cutting off access to liquidity on successive occasions. So it used to be via the banking sector that was stopped. It was used to be via the trust sector that was stopped, private lending groups that was stopped. And then what they did was they said, right, we're going to go to Hong Kong. We're going to start issuing US dollar denominated debt. And this is where this index comes from. So they started issuing US dollar denominated debt, and it went from 0 to 500 billion in less than 18 months. And within that almost twinkling of an eye, the Chinese property market became the biggest issuer of US dollar denominated emerging market debt in the world. And then the Chinese government moved in and clamped down on that too. Now those bonds are trending down and doing so in a big way. And they're down by a third this year. So the peak is around 1400 and we're down to about 950. And it's still going down. So this is problematic because somebody lent these property developers 500 billion and they are sitting on serious losses right now. Now, we don't know who did it. We can opine as to who's holding these bonds, where the losses have taken place, but we don't yet know where the skeletons are buried. But this is a serious problem because at the Party Congress, over the course of last week and this week, there was no talk about rescuing the property market. And that's a problem because this is one of the most asset capital hungry sectors in the world. And property prices are at extraordinary levels. But the problem is that now the property market is political. And in a communist system, politics trumps everything else. And it is not a coincidence that China remains wedded to the COVID zero policy and that property prices are going down. This is not a mistake, this is policy. The one thing that the Communist Party is afraid of is social unrest. So what they are basically doing is locking down the entire country and then attempting to unwind the property bubble in real time. And that's what this trend is showing us. So they think that property prices are too high, that Xi Jinping has said in plain language that he thinks properties are for living in, not for speculating. They still have 50 million units that are empty, and there's just no way that anyone's ever going to live in them while prices are still so high. So this is a clear indication that they want to try and bring property prices down, and they're not going to risk social cohesion because of that. So they're clamping down on the ability of people to move freely. And they're going to try and keep up that policy while they manage the cost of property lower. So this is a really significant issue. And there's no real suggestion yet that it's over. Now, let's look at the US dollar leverage loans. Now, it probably peaked at the beginning of this year, but it has not rolled over just yet. So this is a potential problem in the future because the occupancy in commercial properties is at 40%. It's been at 40% for the last year and a half. There are legions of people who've been given the opportunity to work from home, and they're not going back to the office. I've been working from home since 2007, and I just think that what would I have to be offered in order to go back to the office? My kids are grown now, so they're going to be going off to college in the next year. What would I need to be offered to give up working from the comfort of home and going back to the office and having to waste an hour or two a day commuting? And I just can't think of a number that a company would be willing to give me in order to do that. And I suspect a lot of people feel the same way, but particularly those that have young children. And the privilege that you get from being close to your children as they're in, when they're in their formative years, is, I think, one of the greatest gifts anyone could ever wish for. So there's just going to be a clear reluctance from people to go back to offices just for the sake of going back. And that's a major problem for commercial real estate, because if companies can only fill their offices 40%, they're not going to need as much office space. And then when you look at the expense of real estate in major cities where they were only there in the first place because that's where there was a concentration of people. If you don't need the if you don't need to be where the concentration of people is, well, then you can move to the suburbs yourself. You don't need to be in the downtown. You just move to one of the suburbs. And I see that already in places like where I live in Dallas, Texas. Texas Instruments is out in Plano, which is basically a suburb of Dallas. And it's surrounded by residential buildings. And that makes for a happy commute and an easy way for people to live. And why would you have to turn up in Manhattan or in London and commute in from an hour away, 2 hours away, because you simply can't afford to live or to have a family home in a big city? So these are really significant issues that just aren't going to go away. So I really think that the way to monitor this is through Brookfield Asset Management. And the thing that I find most interesting is the deferential terms that Brookfield has spoken about. That it's been by far the most successful of the property investors and the provision of alternative assets. Now, let's just think about the issues that arose over the last 2 weeks in the UK and the application of leverage to pensions should have been outlawed, and it's certainly against the rules. But financial engineering allowed pensions to take on leverage and they were able to circumvent the rules. Well, it's not like they wanted to, but they basically had to. We've been in an environment over the last 14 years where $17 trillion of debt had a negative yield. So just think about that for a minute and from the perspective of someone who is managing a pension fund, you know that you need between 7.5 and 8% of a return and almost guaranteed to compound at a rate necessary to meet your long-term obligations. And then $17.5 trillion worth of bonds internationally have negative yields. So instead of earning the 8%, you're earning less than zero. Well, that's not going to get you to where you want, and capital appreciation will only go so far. So then they have to go off and go further out the risk curve. So the UK pensions went with leverage. And they engaged in swaps so that they would have to fess up their assets in the event that yields ever went up. So they basically made a one-way bet that the low interest rate or negative real interest rate environment, or excuse me, negative yielding debt environment would last forever. And that's just not the case. And we now have a serious inflation issue that's just not going away. So that's where the issue with the UK pensions has arisen. But then much of the rest of the global pension system took a different solution, and they went with alternative assets. So they basically gave up on the lessons learned during the financial crisis. The lesson that came out of the financial crisis, and it persisted for a good long time, at least a few years, was that buying illiquid assets can really come back and bite you. And unfortunately, the kind of financial engineering that created the credit crisis, which was repackaging of mortgages, well, they didn't buy that anymore. We didn't have the same kind of CMOs on this occasion that we had during the last crisis. But instead, what we have is leveraged loans. So, leveraged loans repackaged lots of loans made to private companies and then sold them on with aggressive yields. And they were the perfect way for funds that were thirsty for yield to achieve the kind of returns that they need. And this has been an issue for sovereign wealth funds, endowments, and pensions, not only in the USA, but everywhere. And this buying of alternative assets means now that major pensions like the CalPERS pension in California, which is for all the public employees, mostly teachers, they now have, I think, 28% in alternative assets. The private pension organization for Canada has 50% of their assets in alternatives. Now, alternatives, they worked fine while interest rates were low. But then we have to think about, well, what actually are alternatives? Well, some people think, well, yes, I mean, there's so many alternatives, so it's impossible to put a number on exactly what they are, because you could have venture capital, private capital, you can have standing timber, farmland, you can have hedge funds. But the really big portion of alternative assets is commercial property. And that brings us back to Brookfield. So Brookfield is revered for a simple reason, because it gave pensions an out. It gave them a solution to their biggest problem. And it put them into commercial properties where there was guaranteed yields and long leases, and then the potential for capital appreciation, and all of the kinds of factors that they require, except for liquidity. You can't sell these kinds of properties immediately. So now the share is rolling over. And this is, I think, the one of the more important ones to pay attention to. The worse it gets for Brookfield Asset Management, the worse it will be for commercial property overall. And this, unfortunately, is one of the things that will contribute to a significant recession. Now, we've seen that leveraged loans haven't yet rolled over, but they will. And then we can think about the high yield market. So high yield spreads have been trending higher, and they're still at around 5.4%. And I suspect that we're going to see high yield spreads coming down over the next few weeks because the stock market has rebounded. And this is also one of the most difficult things about predicting a recession, because the writing can be on the wall for a long time before it actually becomes pressing. So high yield spreads above 500 basis points cause problems in stock markets. And we have not seen a spike yet. So getting up to 1,000 basis points, or at least 800, has been when we've had major lows. That was the case in 2000, certainly the case in 2002, early 2003. Obviously, we had the big spike in 2008, and when it peaked, that was really the low. Now, we can go back in 2011, a major contraction, our corrective phase in stocks, again in 2016, again in 2020. We have not yet had the spike in high yield spreads, but it will come. And we have not yet had a spike in the volatility index. Now, every time the VIX gets up to about 50 is a buying opportunity in stock markets. And we now have this triangular pattern evolving on the VIX. So at present, the index is coming back down through the 30 level. And that suggests that we have some additional upside potential in stocks. But it's going to be short-term in nature. And I don't anticipate it lasting more than about 4 to 6 weeks. And then subsequently, we'll get another pop on the upside. We have a sequence of lower rally highs. We have a sequence of higher reaction lows. As this trading band gets narrower, the potential for an explosive breakout goes up. And then we'll get a spike in the VIX. And that will be where we can anticipate that a meaningful low will have been found in stock markets. Now, as we look at where we are in the broad cycle, well, obviously, monetary conditions are tightening up and credit conditions are getting problematic. So credit tends to lead stock markets, and the credit issues that are appearing right now are not inconsiderable. So therefore, it's likely that we're going to have a recession. There will be surprises and there will be big bankruptcies. And that will eventually turn the tide of monetary and fiscal stimulus. But we're just not there yet. And unfortunately, what we have right now is instead of having the Fed put, what we have is a Fed call. And every time stock markets rally and enthusiasm returns, then the Federal Reserve concludes that there's too much liquidity still in the market. And since unemployment has not risen, then they can continue raising rates, because they're worried about this inflation sticking around for longer. And then we have the oil price. And this is, I think, a really interesting example of how politicians don't understand how markets work. telling the market that the government will step in and support prices at $70. And at the same time, telling oil producers that they should have lower profits and pass on lower prices to their customers. Well, that's not how markets work. If you tell the market that their downside risk is $70, but not $70 on Brent, but $70 on West Texas Intermediate, and prices right now are at 85. Well, you're telling speculators that their risk is 70 and their upside is 130. Therefore, they have a 3-to-1 bet in favor of buying. And global supply is tight, and OPEC is reducing supply. And the US government is saying now that they're going to keep pumping out of the strategic reserve until December, so after the midterm elections. And at the same time, nothing has changed in terms of the regulatory environment and the opprobrium being heaped upon the oil sector. So there's no real incentive to spend the money necessary to boost supply. If we think about Royal Dutch Shell and how they're spending their money, if we look at their capital expenditure, and they're spending around 20 billion a year, but they're not spending that money on massively boosting the supply of gas or oil, but they are spending it on developing some. But a lot of that money is going into LNG. It's going into their network of charging stations. Shell wants to build 500,000 charging stations. And a lot of charging stations are going in around London because of the emissions targeting and the low emission zones that are being expanded and then implemented in an increasing number of cities. So Shell has made the decision they want to be a utility. They want to start generating electricity. And then they're viewing their gas as a transition fuel, and they're minimizing their investments in new oil production. So they are starting new oil production between Malaysia and Brunei, and that's the exception rather than the rule. It doesn't matter what the price of oil is. They've decided that their future is in gas. Exxon made the same determination. And then you have to think about where the money comes from to fund wildcatting, and the endowments aren't there. So a lot of the private capital that would have funded drilling activity in the past has been captured by the ESG movement. So that's certainly problematic. And we can think about those sorts of factors as being, I think, really significant. So when we think about the outlook for the market, it's unlikely there's going to be a lot of investment in new supply unless prices go up significantly or we see a significant contraction in the regulatory headwinds. Now, I think if we go very big picture and we look at the wider global economy, you have Saudi Arabia applying to be a member of the BRIC nomenclature. So that would be Brazil, Russia, India, and China. So they're buddying up with their biggest customers. And The USA is trying to slow down China's development of a domestic chip industry. And it is really slowing it down because it's never going to stop it. China is going to invest as much money as is required to develop their own chips because it's a national security issue. So they are, on the one hand, investing in technology, and on the other, they are trying to limit their exposure to their domestic property market. And the efforts by the USA to continue to raise rates and supporting the strength of the dollar, these are significant issues that they're clearly attempting to get rid of the wider threat from China's emergence as a globally significant economy. So that's one of the issues that they're trying to create a debt issue for China, trying to inhibit the ability to beef up their semiconductor industry. So these are all elements of economic warfare. So we have technological warfare, economic warfare, currency wars, and political wars. And ultimately, it's going to result in a hot war. Now, where that hot water, or excuse me, hot war evolves, it's already in Ukraine. China has not yet made the determination how much assistance they're willing to give to Russia. And that's a brewing question. And they don't have a timeline, so they can decide what to do at any point. But now let's just think about the dollar again. Stock markets rallied today because the dollar was weaker and bond yields paused. But just because the dollar has been rallying and bond yields have been rising in tandem does not mean that that has to always be the case. The dollar could go down and bond yields could go up. And then that would be indicative of a real debt issue and loss of confidence. We already know that China is no longer buying US dollar debt. Japan isn't buying treasuries either. The yen carry trade doesn't work when yields are rising this fast. We saw an intervention to support the yen again in here today from this psychological 150 level, but it's not a sufficiently large downward dynamic to suggest that this is anything other than an attempt to moderate the decline of the yen. If the dollar is going to trend lower in a big way, then other currencies have to go up. And nobody wants a strong currency right now. So even though the dollar has had three downside key reversals, then we would need to see serious economic challenges for the US that they can tolerate a strong currency at present because the economy is strong and unemployment is low. At some point, we're going to get to a low growth, higher unemployment environment, and then it will be more than likely involuntary that the dollar goes down, and then we'll see currency competition and a lot more volatility. And the upside key reversals we're seeing right now in gold are straws in the wind to suggest that gold will be one of the assets that does best in a dollar bearish environment. And then we can think about stock markets in emerging countries that will benefit from great power competition between the USA and Europe and China. So Indonesia rebounded in rather emphatic fashion in here today. And this range that's been forming for most of the year looks like a first step above that long range that proceeded from 2018 through to 2021. And this looks like an upside weekly queue reversal. And the Indonesian rupiah was very steady for a long time, and it is now devaluing, and the government is stepping in to try and arrest the decline. The Indian rupee has also been weakening recently and is beginning to show some evidence of pausing, and the Nifty index has been really very steady. So it's firming again now from the region of the 200-day moving average. Then Brazil has had the benefit of having one of the stronger currencies in the world, and then the index was up in a dynamic manner as well in here this week. Now, if the dollar pauses, much less if it rolls over and is accompanied by weakness in the US economy, well, we've had significant valuation contraction everywhere else. But then let's think about where the epicenter of risk is. Because we've had a 14-year bull trend of financial engineering. And the assets that have done best are those that benefit from exceptionally low interest rates and the willingness of the Federal Reserve to step in and support asset prices on a continual basis. Now, China stopped doing that 2 years ago, and now they're looking at their property market rolling over. And that willingness to no longer play the leverage game is now also in the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is looking at rallies in asset prices as signals to continue to tighten. So eventually that's going to create an asset price pop, and we're going to see significant asset price depreciation. And it will eventually create a deflationary impact on the economy. So then the kinds of assets that have not been engaged in financial engineering are precious metals and emerging markets. Brazil has not benefited from the financial engineering trend, and it does benefit from higher commodity prices, and it does have a large domestic consumer base. And there's going to be aggressive infrastructure building because of great power politics. And the number one thing that every country in the world is focusing on right now is energy independence. Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And we can argue about the rationale behind it until we're blue in the face. But the reality is that Europe was totally dependent on Russia for imports. NATO's expansion into Eastern Europe, was something that was viewed in Russia as a threat, and they responded. And now the reality has been brought home to Europe as a whole that relying on a neighboring power that you're intentionally agitating is not such a good idea. Europe is now talking about an energy price cap. Now, Japan hasn't had the same kind of energy problem as Europe because they've had long-term contracts for natural gas. Europe did not want long-term contracts. They wanted to buy spot. And now they are facing the issue with what that represents. It's also an indication of the issues that Europe has, that with a large aging population, the penny-pinching decisions that have been made, particularly with regard to energy, because it was regarded as not risky, are now coming back as serious issues for those governments. Well, Brazil, Indonesia have domestic energy and are largely self-sufficient. So they're in a better position. And they have large young populations. And, well, perhaps not as young as they used to be in Brazil, but that's certainly the case for Indonesia. Mexico just nationalized their lithium in just the same way that they've nationalized their oil. They've just signed a deal with Germany to supply them with LNG for the next 20 years. So they're going to have to build an export facility. So Mexico is another country that's going to benefit from great power politics. So these are the kinds of places that will do better. What I find especially interesting is that the Turkey ETF is at the upper side of its base formation. I highlighted in comment of the day within the next or the last few weeks that the US dollar denominated debt in Turkey has not been blowing out. And that despite the fact that the Turkish lira has been in practically a death spiral. But Turkey still controls the head of the Bosphorus. And it's not nearly as involved politically with Europe and the USA as we might like to hope. So it's been courted by Russia as to become a major gas export terminal. And this is being reflected in the performance of the ETF. It's coming back up to the upper side of its base formation. Turkey has the potential to recapture its position as a geopolitical choke point and to charge a tax for safe transit through the Bosphorus. So there's a lot going on in terms of emerging markets. And India is another major beneficiary where you have a massive young population. And it's being viewed as the bulwark against China's expansion in Asia. So there isn't going to be any problem with technology transfer to India. And it's going to get all the help it needs in order to modernize from the rest of the world to act as a counterbalance to China. So we're going to see a lot more investment in infrastructure. It's really only a question of how much demand destruction will there be in China. And then, of course, that brings us to what happens with copper prices. Because copper was up in here today, and Freeport-McMoRan was up in a dynamic manner. It was, I think it jumped by nearly 10%. So that was on the back of earnings that were pretty much in line. They're talking about a strikingly tight physical situation. So copper is still trading below the 1,000-day moving average. That range in 2021 looks like a type 2 top formation, and now we have the first consolidation or first range below the top. So copper's got a lot of work to do in order to demonstrate that the low is in fact in. And it's going to be a lot more influenced by what happens in China than anywhere else. If China continues on the COVID zero policy, which appears likely, then demand for copper is not going to be as high. That, of course, will free up supply for electric batteries, for EVs, for wind turbines and transmission lines from these remote locations to where the energy is actually required. And it doesn't mean that copper prices have to explode on the upside if Chinese demand moderates. Of course, we do have this push-pull because nobody wants to build a new mine. It really suggests that the mines that do exist have real utility and value because they can't be increased. It takes about 10 years to build a new copper mine. And nobody wants to build new copper mines. And the way that expansion is happening is through expansion and investment in existing properties. So it's very hard to have a big supply response. What we need is for a transfer of demand from China to the electrification sector. And that's going to be bumpy at best and may not happen at all at worst, which means that the pace with which electrification will happen is probably not nearly as fast as the rest of the world might like, and particularly the ESG sector. We're going to be looking at natural gas and oil demand being intact for years to come. So it's not like there aren't going to be opportunities. There will be. But credit leads stock markets, and the issues in the credit market are multiplying, and they're not over. And this escalation of great power politics and the willingness of the USA to use the dollar as a weapon, all of that is contributing to the problems that we're facing, which means that I think investors will need to have confidence that they have clear value and a route to profitability before investing in companies. And value is now outperforming growth, and it has a first step above the base formation, and it's above the 1,000-day moving average on a relative basis. We are looking at value making a comeback because value needs a discount rate for the dividend discount model to work. And that means that with higher interest rates, value will start performing again. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.